This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. July 16th, 1945 marked the beginning of the atomic age. The detonation of the first nuclear explosive was such a landmark event that today geologists are proposing that it be used as the start date for a whole new epoch in Earth's history. There are many men and a few women whose work was instrumental in bringing about that historic day. One of the chief architects of the atomic age was the Italian physicist Enrico Fermi. A new book tells the story of Fermi's life, from his meager beginnings, his rise to the top of his field, the impact of Benito Mussolini and fascism, and of course, his involvement in the Manhattan Project. The book is called The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. The authors are Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin, and they join me now from a studio at WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Gino, you share a surname with Emilio Segre, who was a graduate student of Fermi's, a close colleague throughout his life. You yourself are a physicist. Is there a family connection here?
Well, there certainly is a family connection, more than even a close associate. When Fermi was appointed to a professorship at the University of Rome, there were essentially no physics students. So they went over to the engineering class and said, anybody interested? We have a new person on the staff. And Emilio, who was then a third-year engineering student, said, how about me? And became Fermi's first student. And that was the beginning of a collaboration that lasted the rest of their lives.
But I can also say that he was your uncle.
Yeah, that's true.
Emilio Segre was your uncle, so...
I forgot that.
Details.
Yeah. And his Nobel Prize, you probably forgot that, too.
That, too. Yeah, it certainly was an influence on me. But even aside from that, also, I did much of my growing up in Italy, and Fermi was a hero to young kids who wanted to be scientists.
Bettina, you also connect to Enrico Fermi's story in personal ways. Talk a little bit about, I understand you met Fermi.
I did indeed. I met Fermi when I was a teenager. My family had moved post-war to Los Alamos, the atomic city. They had moved there in 1953. Our first time in Los Alamos was the summer of 1953. That happened to coincide with Fermi's last summer at Los Alamos. And Fermi was part of a tradition there, a very European tradition of Sunday outings. The many refugees on the Mesa at that point would gather on a Sunday and go hiking or mushroom hunting, something like that. And I recall him from several hikes. My father was a serious mountaineer, had held the world record at one point, and he would say, my father in his heavy German accent, I never had to worry about Fermi, and because Fermi was a terrific hiker, and he seemed to me, there I was a teenager among these grown-ups, a few other teenagers along, but he seemed to me the most normal of the physicists, which was quite a relief for me as a teenager, because if teenagers seek anything, they seek normal.
And the two of you seem like the perfect couple to write this book. You are a husband and wife team, a physicist and an author. Fermi was a physicist. His wife was a writer. But of course, you guys have been married for a few decades. Why choose to write a book about Fermi now?
There were many reasons for that. I think the main one is that there really wasn't a book about Fermi, and he really is one of the greats of 20th century physics. He's the only physicist to reach the very peaks as both a theorist and an experimentalist, and he's the last physicist to have really worked on all areas of physics. So he's a little-known physics hero, at least a hero to the physicists. And we thought it would be a good book to try for us.
Yeah, I think the unique part of it is that we did this together. Gino actually was writing the book, and he and I have a relationship where we read each other's writings, we critique each other's writings, and I was doing that for, at that point, his book on Fermi, and I got more and more involved with this. It was more than, oh, can't you just change this word? It became much more than editing. It became a reconceptualization of the book. And the more I got involved and the deeper I got, the more it became clear that this would have to be co-authorship, something that Gino proposed to his editor at Henry Holt, and the editor said, that sounds great. So it has been a very fruitful partnership for us that has been fascinating in terms of our own marriage and not filing for divorce at the end of the book.
Well, that's certainly good news.
Yeah, yes. That really is good news.
We need good news these days.
I had written three previous books on 20th century science, so I thought this is going to be not so hard. And then as I got more into the subject, even though I know a lot about Fermi, I found myself increasingly in awe of him as a physicist and losing somewhat sight of the times he had lived in, the effect they had on him, and in turn the effect he had on them. And that's when Bettina stepped in, and I must compliment her on, she did learn a lot of physics. her father had tried but failed, but yes, I succeeded.
Yes.
Let's talk about the title of the book. It's a little jarring maybe to hear Pope and physics in the same phrase. What's the significance of that title, the Pope of Physics?
When Fermi started in Rome, he organized a small group, but he was always a great team builder. So there were five or six young physicists who worked with him, and they were a jolly bunch. And a somewhat, so they all took nicknames. Fermi became the Pope. You have to remember, this is Rome, too, so there's a lot of ecclesiastical references. Fermi became the Pope because everybody agreed that he was infallible. His sidekick, Franco Rosetti, was known as the Cardinal. Majorana was known as the Grand Inquisitor. My uncle, who had a bad temper, was known as the Basilisk, that being a fire-spitting monster. So they used to refer to each other this way, not by their names, and they would say, hey, the Pope is out of the room, or the Cardinal is gone. And I think it has a lot to do with this being Rome.
But I think the other part of that name was that Gino talked about being in awe of Fermi, but his peers were in awe of him, and they regarded him as infallible, that he just didn't make mistakes in terms of science. Of course, he did make some mistakes, and perhaps we'll talk about that, but he was so spot on in terms of his scientific instincts that really gave extra weight to this feeling, somewhat irreverent name of the Pope.
In case you're just joining us, my guests are Bettina Herlin and Gino Segre, authors of The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi, and The Birth of the Atomic Age. In writing a biography, it wouldn't be unusual to start with someone's parents. You guys actually start a step or so back from that with the history of Italy, the fact that Italy wasn't even a country when Fermi's father was born. Why did you think that was the place to start this story?
Well, we wanted to emphasize, I think, that Fermi grew up in a country that was in many ways still backward at that time compared to Germany, France, and England. Half the population at 1870, when Rome was finally became part of Italy officially, was illiterate. And when Fermi grew up, there was essentially nobody in physics. He is also the only major 20th century physicist to be entirely self-taught.
Well, I want to ask you about
that
phrase.
Hadn't gone to college.
I mean, you say he's entirely self-taught. He did go to school. He went to university. So what do you mean that he was self-taught?
That there was nobody in Italy who was up to date on modern physics, on quantum physics and relativity. He learned it by himself. He read books. He, his start in physics was when he was 14, he went to Campo dei Fiori, which is a market, now a vegetable and fruit market in Rome. But he picked up a 900-page book written by a Roman priest in 1830 about mathematical physics. And he read it and he said, "This is great," and started picking up books. And that's the way.
I particularly love that story. I'm going to interrupt because here you have this 14-year-old with his allowance going to bookstalls and finding this 900-page, 2-volume work. It just is sort of boggling, you know, that he didn't spend his money on gelato and instead chose to have this book that was written in the 1830s by a monk.
One of his most important pieces of work was a paper published in 1926. He was still a very young man. What was the significance of that paper? What was the substance?
We now call electrons, protons, and neutrons, we call them fermions. In metals and in other condensed material, we say they live in the Fermi Sea, which rises up to the Fermi surface. And this is all based on what is called Fermi statistics. Namely, this paper really created a basis for understanding the conduction of electricity in metals, the magnetic properties of metals, and therefore led to much of the modern world we know of. Of course, technology always follows at a distance, but this was the paper that really made Fermi a star on the international scene.
It was about 12 years later, 1938, when he won a Nobel Prize. Can you explain the work that led to that?
He's the only physicist in the 20th century to have been both a great theorist and a great experimentalist. So his early work in his 20s is known for known for his contributions to theory. But actually, already in high school, he had decided that he wanted to be both a theorist and an experimentalist. And that's, you see that already in his college days. He published some papers on relativity, but he also did experimental work. So in the 1930s, when nuclear physics, at the dawn of nuclear physics, people were doing scattering off nuclei. And he said, "I think I can use a new technique." And he introduced it. And that new technique was to create a beam of neutrons and use those to scatter off nuclear targets and see what resulted. And that's what his Nobel Prize was. His Nobel Prize was for his experimental work. Which he did. He led it, but then he formed a team in Rome, affectionately known in Italy as I Ragazzi di Via Panisperna, the boys of Via Panisperna, because that's where the Physics Institute was.
You mentioned that, you know, the breadth of his work within physics, the fact that he was both a theorist and an experimentalist, which was rare, and also had an amazing facility with mathematics. And there's something called the Fermi method. What is that?
Bettina, you want to try the Fermi
method? I'm not sure I'm that good at physics at this point. Why don't you, I'll interrupt you and I'll correct you. How about that?
That's good. Okay, Bettina, how many piano tuners are there in the city of Chicago?
Yeah, he had this wonderful way of teaching, which were estimates, essentially, but estimates based on knowledge, but also based on a kind of intuition. And his way of teaching was students, and he had great relationship with his students. He ate lunch with them at the University of Chicago. He went hiking with them. He loved challenging them. He was a tennis player and a swimmer, and he was highly competitive. But anyway, the estimates that he tried to get students to think in terms of multiples, to think what makes sense. And so he would ask questions like, how many tuners are there in the city of Chicago? He would ask questions like, how much dust, given how much is on the windowsill, how much dust do you think is in this room? He had a bunch of hypotheticals that were really to get people to think in a very global way, I think, and also, according to his students anyway, this gave them a lot of confidence in the way that they approach physics because they had been taken through these exercises a number of times.
I remember a quote from one of them. He said, he made us feel we could understand anything. And in fact, I don't necessarily want to jump into Los Alamos right away, but I think this was a very useful property, and it's that he would always estimate what was going to happen. And so he had this sort of nimbleness that few other people had, and I think it comes in part from his combination of being both a theorist and an experimentalist. He knew as a theorist what might happen. As an experimentalist, he knew what he could measure. And that going back and forth was just almost unique. But he tried to instill that in his students.
Of course, he had a strong dose of intuition. Gino, you have to say it in Italian because it sounds much better. What was it?
Well, they would joke, and students say, Fermi, how did you figure that out? How do you know? And he would joke and say, con intuito formidabile, with formidable intuition, and laugh, and then explain the reasoning behind that. There's a legendary one where he gave a seminar trying to estimate the probability that we had already been visited by extraterrestrials. So he says, how many stars in the galaxy, how many planets, how many ones have civilization, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of the estimate, he said, it seems to me a fair chance that we might have been visited already. And a fellow professor, Leo Szilard, who was a Hungarian, said, but Enrico, they're already here. We just call them Hungarians.
That's Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin. They're the authors of The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Bettina Herlin and Gino Segre, authors of The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. One thing that you highlight in the book over and over is just how fragmented Europe was in the 1920s and into the 30s. Different nations known for different strengths in the sciences, they all had their different journals. And in fact, there were times when the discoveries of one scientist weren't known to others because they published in an Italian journal versus a German journal or versus an English journal. I mean, this seems really foreign to the way that the world, and in particular the scientific community, operates today.
I agree with you. It is foreign. Nowadays, email lets you know almost immediately what is being discovered. In fact, in physics, there is an email. For instance, I get an email every day listing the new papers that are published, in at least in particle physics. But then the world was still fragmented. And of course, Fermi knew that. And since nobody bothered to read Italian journals because they all thought there's nothing happening in Italy, he would always, at least for the papers that he wrote that he regarded as significant, he would publish a version then in either English or German until 1933 or 1934. They were always in German. After Hitler came to power, Fermi switched to publishing them in English. But for political reasons, there was always an Italian version. And so most of his papers, you'll see there's an Italian version, and then there's first either the German version and later the English version.
As Fermi was coming of age and beginning his career, that really coincided with the rise of Benito Mussolini and fascism in Italy. How did Fermi respond to that? Was he a political person?
He was legendarily apolitical. He really kept his head low. Part of this, I think, was maybe self-preservation, but I think the bigger part of it was really that he was wed to physics. This was his reason for living. This is what he was motivated by. This was almost like a religion to him in terms of his dedication to it. And so he felt that physics was something he knew about. Politics was something he didn't know about. And he was not going to make stands, and he was not going to use his fame in Italy, and he had considerable fame, to make it a platform. As a matter of fact, one of the things he later on, almost with disdain, talked about physicists who walked the corridors of power. This is while he was in the United States. He felt that that was not the role of physics. The role of physics was to uncover as much knowledge as you could possibly uncover. So that was his attitude. Of course, one of the things that did impinge on this is that he married someone who was Jewish. She was an assimilated Jew, Laura Fermi, quite a remarkable woman, incidentally. And they married and everything was fine, but then as it became clearer and clearer that there were going to be restrictions of all kinds, certainly on physics, but also racist laws, and they had two children, then he became, you couldn't ignore the politics, and that is when he decided to fled. Of course, he had one of the classier ways of exiting. He picked up his Nobel Prize in Sweden on his way to America.
I mean, but before that, though, he had actually benefited in some ways from Mussolini's rise. He'd gotten a position conferred by Mussolini. Do you think that was ever a source of tension?
Tension
within his family, within his marriage.
Within his family, yes. I think that his wife, who really, I think, changed over time, but she grew up in a very bourgeois way. She was used to certain comforts. She had a very comfortable upbringing, and I think that she expected to have a very nice and comfortable life, and that money that he got, it almost doubled his academic salary by being part of the Royal Academy, was something that allowed it. I don't think there was a lot of questioning about it. The fact that he was part of the academia, the academy there, the Royal Academy, he thought it was ridiculous that there was a uniform with lots of pomp and circumstance. That was not Fermi. He was a very modest man. But he certainly enjoyed the largesse of Mussolini in terms of that appointment. But I would like to note that when he did win the Nobel Prize, he was roundly criticized by the Italian press for not giving the fascist salute, and this was in Stockholm, and not wearing the uniform of the academy.
But I don't think there was tension in the family. If anything, Laura's father was an admiral in the Italian Navy, and therefore a loyal government servant. Even to the very end, he did not flee Italy because he thought, even though I'm Jewish, I know Mussolini, and he tragically died in Auschwitz. But coming back to the period of the 20s and 30s, though Fermi did not protest fascism, he went to the United States for the first time in the summer of 1930, And I think it was a bit of a love affair with the United States. He went back in the summers of 33, 34, 35, 36. And he seriously thought of emigrating to the United States. He both loved life in the United States, and he thought, this is the country of the future in science, and that's where I want to be. I think it was, if anything, his wife, who was at the time more a bourgeois Italian, that kept him from emigrating. In that sense, there's a real contrast between Fermi, say, and Heisenberg. They met in the United States. Again, they had met several times, but they met in the United States in the summer of 39. And Fermi tried to convince Heisenberg to come stay in the United States. Heisenberg said, no, I have to go back to Germany. My country needs me. And Fermi said, Heisenberg, I was a big shot in Italy, and now I'm just an ordinary physicist, which is what I always wanted to be. Isn't that so much better? And Heisenberg said, no, my country needs me. I have to go back. Fermi never thought about that.
One reviewer writing for the Wall Street Journal said that your book left him with the nagging idea that, kind of there but for the grace of God, Fermi might have wound up in the same situation as Heisenberg, developing nuclear weapons for Mussolini, were it not for the fact that his wife were Jewish. Do you think that that could have been a possibility?
Well, it's hard to say. I think he would have pressured his wife to come to the United States one way or another, even if she wasn't Jewish. I don't think he wanted to stay in Italy. In any case, though, Mussolini would not have developed nuclear weapons. There was not the infrastructure in Germany, I mean in Italy, for that. Whether the Germans would have drafted him to do that, I don't think so. I think he would have been in the United States, as we say, come hell or high water.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that when he landed in the United States on January 2nd, 1939, with his wife, Laura, and his two children, they got off the boat and he turned to them beaming and saying, we have now established the American branch of the Fermi family. He felt very beholden to this country. He had, as Gino said, he had had a lot of exposure to it. He religiously read the comics and the Reader's Digest as a way to pick up some of the lingo, some of the sayings. And I think that in a way, you know, people say you got to follow the money. Well, his money, his life was science, and he was following the science. American science was hugely exciting, based partly on the fact that so many immigrants had come from Germany and Hungary, and also, of course, Italy. This is where it was happening, and I think that would have been convincing to him to come.
How long was Fermi and his family in America before he started actually working on developing a nuclear weapon?
He had a professorship at Columbia when he got here, and the Columbia lab was really set up to develop new experiments, and he would come home covered with graphite from the experiments. And then they basically said, we have to have a concerted effort to do this. There were separate efforts at Columbia, Berkeley,
Chicago, Princeton,
and
you know.
Princeton. Those were the main ones. And they said, we have to start getting our team together. And that's when they started assembling at Chicago. And they attempted there to make a controlled nuclear nuclear fission in terms of a chain reaction, which was his very successful experiment in 1942.
Apparently under an old football field?
Under a defunct football field. I told that to a friend of mine, and they said, Chicago never had football, did they? But they did. So I think at that point, it was well known among those scientists working on it that this was something that they were developing also with the potential of it becoming an atomic bomb.
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked at the very beginning that July 16th, 1945 is the birth of the atomic age. But many people think that December 2nd, 1942, which is the time under the football field, is the birth of the atomic age, because that's the, in fact, at 3:52 in the afternoon on December 2nd, 1942, the so-called nuclear pile that Fermi had built or led the building of, that's when they obtained the first self-sustaining chain reaction, and that was the key. So you could say maybe that's the birth of the atomic age, and Fermi was at the helm for that event.
I mean, the fact that Fermi was at the helm for the first self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction arguably makes him the man single-handedly most responsible for nuclear weapons, and he was, of course, then a few years later present at the detonation of Trinity, the first nuclear bomb. And you actually, the prologue to your book is the story of what he was doing during that detonation. Can you tell us that story?
On that morning on July 16th, when the mushroom cloud appeared in the sky and the physicists around it knew what this meant, the reactions were at least recorded of many. There's a famous statement that Oppenheimer made as he saw the cloud rise in the sky. He said, a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, a Sanskrit classic, he said, "Now I am death, the destroyer of worlds." Ken Bainbridge, another physicist who had been a key person there, turned to Oppenheimer and more prosaically said, "Now we're all sons of bitches." And I remember my uncle, who was tried to be very rational, had this momentary fear that the sky was burning, that the world was lighting up. But Fermi, ever rational, he said, "This is another physics experiment." And he was seen ripping up pieces of paper as the mushroom cloud rose and counting. When it reached 40 seconds where he was located, he tossed the pieces of paper in the air. At that moment, the blast from the shockwave from the blast came by him, blew the pieces of paper. He measured off with his feet how far the pieces of paper had blown, took out a little chart he had made up ahead of time, and said, 10 tons of TNT. This is part of the Fermi legend of being able to calculate anything, estimate anything, including the first atomic bomb, as the explosion went off.
And of course, he was not infallible. He was not right on, but he was far closer than any of his colleagues who had also been betting on how big this explosion had been.
He never said that he was going to be exactly right on. What he used to say was, "In one day, I can calculate anything in physics to within 50%. If you want me to do it to 10%, it might take me a few weeks or maybe even a few months. But in one day, I can calculate anything to within a factor of two." And this was right to within a factor of two.
That's Gino Segre, also Bettina Herland. They're the authors of The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi, and The Birth of the Atomic Age. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this hour are Gino Segre and Bettina Herland, authors of The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi, and The Birth of the Atomic Age. Now, Enrico Fermi was one of four scientific advisors on a panel who actually recommended dropping the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II. Do we know what Fermi's reaction was to that actually happening?
I don't think there's any specific accounting of that. I think that his role in that as being one of four physicists, that included Oppenheimer, incidentally, to make that decision was one where he provided that group with mainly with the technical aspects, with the scientific aspects. That group concluded that there was no acceptable alternative. It was at a time when there was a lot of controversy within the physics community about what should be done with a bomb once it was built. And there were scientists, James Franck at the University of Chicago was kind of the leader of that, saying that what we should do is have a demonstration, invite the Japanese at some remote site, perhaps people from other countries as well, to show the power and the destructiveness of this weapon, and that will prevent war, that will stop this war. Other people felt that the logistics of that were going to be enormous, the issues around that were going to be enormous, and they were operating in a very pressurized environment to get the bomb built. They had been doing this in an incredible effort, the Manhattan Project, in a very short time frame. There were 100,000 people involved. And here they were so close to having it built and using it, that they felt that their efforts, the money, the $2 billion that the government had invested, that this was the way to end the war. This was not necessarily only to end the war in terms of the Japanese, but also in terms of all future wars. So, and that if you did a demonstration, people wouldn't know, well, is that maybe they only have one bomb, and would the right people be there, and how could this get out? But the four scientists, the scientific panel, did make this recommendation of no acceptable alternative other than to drop it, essentially on a civilian population without warning, much as Pearl Harbor had been done. And they, at the same time, stipulated in their recommendation that there was no special competence that they had, that they were people who were not necessarily competent to make political judgments. They were making a judgment that was based on what they saw as the science of it, as what they saw as the technical aspects of it.
Yeah, let me jump in for a moment here. The government formed an interim committee, interim because it would be disbanded after the war. And the interim committee was asked to make a recommendation, and they formed then a scientific panel. And the scientific panel was advisory to the interim committee. The scientific panel was formed, as Bettina said, of four people. It was Oppenheimer plus the three most prestigious scientists on the Manhattan Project, all three Nobel Prize winners, Arthur Compton, Ernest Lawrence, and Enrico Fermi. And they were asked, as scientists, can you see a way, what would be the best way to bring the war to a quick conclusion? Or do you see any alternatives to using it against a city that had not previously been destroyed? By that point, so many Japanese cities had been completely leveled. I mean, 100,000 people were killed in the firebombing of Tokyo. So this wasn't slaughter on a new scale, but it was a new weapon.
Shortly after Japan surrendered, Fermi left Los Alamos, returned to Chicago. Bettina, you grew up in Los Alamos. Can you provide any insight into what life there might have been like for Fermi's wife and family during World War II?
Yeah, Los Alamos was a very hierarchical place. It was a place where everybody had a similar mission. So there was that kind of democracy too at small d. But there it was, very much of an army base. It was in one of the more beautiful spots in the world, I will say. But in terms of the housing, it was barracks, it was mud. It was very primitive, and I think life was very tough, particularly on the women, and they were mainly women who followed their spouses to Los Alamos. And it was also a place where nobody could talk about what their husbands did. And again, a few cases, what their wives did. Everything was top secret. So you had a strange community of people gathered there. It was also, I think, there's a book called The Cult of Masculinity, or there's a chapter called The Cult of Masculinity at Los Alamos. There's another book written by the wife of a scientist, Jane Wilson, and the wife is called Standing By. And the role of the wives there, I think, was to support their husbands and not to ask them what they were doing. It must have been hugely stressful. And at one point, I gather there were quite a few signs of stress within the community. And at that point, Oppenheimer was very concerned about it, talked to a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist said, well, I think you need to create some roles for the wives. So their wives were given, they were teachers, they were people who were called computers. They did almost all the computational work at Los Alamos. Laura Fermi herself was working in the hospital in a radiation lab. So they did make their contributions, but it was a tough environment to be in, and I think Laura Fermi did find her way, and her children went to school there, as many of the other scientists benefited from having very good teachers at that school.
I think it's also important to remember how young they were. Fermi, when he went to Los Alamos at 41, was one of the oldest people. The average age was something like 26. And so this was a bunch of kids in a way.
Yeah, the birth rate was also very high in Los Alamos.
Seems ironic.
Yes, and so one of the, well, I think the birth rate went up after various brownouts and blackouts on the East Coast, too. But anyway, the birth rate was very high. And I think some of the medical people approached Oppenheimer and said, we have to talk to people. They have to cease and desist or something. And Oppenheimer's answer was to have a child, I think, about 10 months after he had been approached about that. So I don't think anybody was listening.
And by the way, we know a few of those children now grown up, now in their early 70s, and their birth certificate says P.O. Box 1663. I think I have the numbers right. Santa Fe, because it was a secret city. So the birth certificate doesn't say Los Alamos. It says a post office box. I think they're the only people I know who were born in post office boxes.
I think that's probably pretty unique. I mean, you mentioned that of course, the work was secret while it was going on. Eventually, it was inevitable that it would become known what Fermi was doing. How did his family respond? How did they feel about the work that he had done?
Well, I think probably Laura Fermi was, they were all taken back in a way. They were so, people at Los Alamos were very thrilled that the war had come to an end and that they played a role in that. And then they started realizing that people were looking at this decision to drop the bomb as something monstrous, as something horrible, as a new way of death that was abhorrent. And they started grappling with some of the moral questions. And I think each of them did that in different ways. Laura Fermi talks about the fact, yes, there were the moral questions, but she doesn't say how she would have handled that particular situation. It is notable that she, after Famry's death, actually, was the designated reporter for the first international conference on peaceful uses of atomic energy, and she became somewhat of a peacenik. Again, this is after his death, where she, I think, realized the full import of what had happened. But it was a very mixed reaction, people happy that the war ended and people realizing that the world would never be the same.
Yeah, I think that there's a well-known physicist named Robert Wilson, who became the director of the largest accelerator in the United States and promptly renamed it Fermi Lab in honor of Fermi, a man he adored. And Wilson was one of the pioneers of nuclear medicine right after the war ended. And he said, I spent so many years trying to kill people. I want to spend the next years trying to help people, pure and simple, with the physics I know.
I mean, you mentioned Fermi Lab. There are so many things named after Fermi, the fermion particle, fermium the element, Fermi method, Fermi statistics, Fermi paradox. You know, we could go on and on. What do you think is the greatest lasting legacy of Enrico Fermi?
The legacy, there are so many legacies. Certainly as a scientist, as a teacher, he shaped American physics. The physics department that he led in Chicago produced, depending on how you read it, 6, 7, 10, depending on his own influence, Nobel Prizes. So there's certainly his legacy as a teacher. There's his legacy as an experimentalist, as a theorist. I think it's the whole man. But it's also the question, there is another legacy, and that legacy is, how do you deal with the changes in technology? How do you deal with the development of a weapon? And this brings us back to social questions. Part of his legacy, I would like to think, is that we all need to reflect on how to deal with the rapid changes in technology, how they affect the world we live in.
Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin are co-authors of a new biography of Enrico Fermi entitled The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. Thank you both so much.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
As I mentioned at the start of the show, there were a few women in the elite ranks of earlier nuclear physics. Marie Curie, of course, her daughter, Irene Joliot-Curie, and Lise Meitner, the Austrian physicist who first discovered nuclear fission. Tune in on November 28th, 1 month from today, for the story of those women's work and lives and a discussion of why it's so important to tell the stories of innovative women. Again, that's November 28th. In the meantime, check out our website, capeandislands.org. We've got some special spooky science there today in honor of Halloween. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Happy Halloween, everybody, and thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.